The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we have such a packed program. This is going to be a rather serious and intense week. I'm going to talk today with Professor Francis Boyle in the third part of our program about the international right of Palestinians to return and a look at the Palestinian quest for statehood at the UN, and why has the American media joined forces in denouncing this, especially President Obama and this administration, both Democrats and Republicans. We'll provide a counterpoint. I'm going to give part two, an original in-depth investigative report on vaccines, real science, the myth that vaccination equals immunization. After all, for those of you who receive a vaccine, it's always with the idea that when you're vaccinated for smallpox, chickenpox, measles, hepatitis, you are then going to have antibodies that will protect you for life from that contagion. That is not true. I will give you the actual peer-reviewed literature to show you that this is a massive public fraud. That will be a special in-depth investigative report today on our program. The latest on health and healing, a letter from Senator Chuck Schumer showing why he supports the FDA, he supports the Senate Dietary Supplement Labeling Act of 2011, Senate Bill 1310, and why he believes the FDA is a completely legitimate organization only there to represent the American consumer on health issues. He is wrong on all counts. I will challenge Senator Schumer's assertions on today's program. The latest on the environment. The polls are shifting, ever so slightly. Here's what no one is telling you. I'll tell you first. You think that the only way the oceans will rise is where more water goes in from melting glaciers. That's reasonable, and that's accurate. It's half the story. Why is it that in nations that have been suffering severe drought, prolonged drought, entire fishing villages are being inundated, no longer able to be there? They're underwater. How did that water get there? If you have massive flooding, you can say it's from the floods, from the monsoons. What if there were no monsoons? What if there were no floods? Shifting at the tectonic plates is causing the ocean to heave up. That's causing waves to come in at night, hundreds of yards. Whole nations that are at ground level now are threatened. New information, ahead of the curve, completely scientific. What they're not telling you about, global shifts, polar shifts, what this means for those people living near or at sea level, and literally the annihilation of life as we know it in the South Pacific, in the Marshall Islands. They will all be underwater in 100 years, 50 years, try 3 to 5 years from now. We're not talking about something in the future. We're talking about right now. And if you go back, do you remember I found an anomaly? It was 5 years ago. I was jogging in a beach, South Beach, from the tip of South Beach, 10 miles I jogged. And I noticed as I was jogging early in the morning when the tides went out that there was seaweed and water marks going up the walls of swimming pools and buildings that were on the beach. Oh, that's odd. Because we didn't have any surge, we didn't have any rain, we didn't have any hurricane, and you could see the seaweed on the beach. Now, understand, underneath all those buildings and high-rise and luxury hotels and condominiums, there are over 10,000 of them going up, clear up, Juniper, Florida, West Palm Beach, clear up. Those are all built on sand, all on sand. You can have a concrete piling that is 20 feet, 50 feet, 100 feet driven into the ground, but it rests on sand. If the water's coming in at night at a higher tide, that means that water's going into the ground, and sooner or later, inevitably, the water will destabilize the pilings. They will shift the weight. When that happens, all those buildings will be, in effect, made uninhabitable. Because what are you going to do? You can support the pilings, but it's still, at the end of the day, just like Dubai, I predicted, and I will predict again, I will go on the record, that the nearly trillion dollars spent thus far on what is considered one of the most beautiful cities in the world, that I would agree with. I mean, the architecture in Dubai is just spectacular. It is the best I've ever seen. But unfortunately made with slave labor. But under a ruthless monarchy. But it's all built at sea level. Some of it actually in the ocean itself. Those fan palms that were considered so unique. They built sand islands out into the ocean to configure a palm leaf. And they had like hundreds of houses on a given street. Hence thousands of homes on these little palm islands with big hotels in the middle. All of those now are suffering from architectural cracks. The roofs are cracking, the foundations are cracking, the water pipes are broken. Uninhabitable. You invested, you're stupid, you lost. All right? For everyone who thought they would just get rich and invest there, will buy a $5 million house, and 2 years it'll be worth $10 million, everyone in the world wants to live there, that might have been true. Now, the ocean's going to take all of Dubai back, all of it. And I wouldn't hesitate to say that within 10 years, the world's largest building will also be structurally challenged because it's all built on sand. There is no hard rock. Gee whiz, how could so many engineers, architects, designers have gotten the basics wrong? Let me think. Money. That's how they got it wrong. That's how most everything gets wrong. Oh, and did you doubt for a moment that our interest in the economy and helping us get over this bad hump was due to Wall Street wanting to help us, the government wanting to help us? The BBC had on a person this morning who was actually honest. Can you imagine that? A leading broker, a leading economist who was honest about why we're in this and what you can do when you're in it, and how they're all working hard to help us? You think so? Think again.
It's going to crash, and it's going to fall pretty hard because markets are ruled right now by fear. Investors and the big money, the smart money, I'm talking about the big funds, the hedge funds, the institutions, they don't buy this rescue plan. They know the market is toast. They know the stock market is finished. The euro, as far as they're concerned, they don't really care. They're moving their money away to safer assets, like treasury bonds, 30-year bonds, and the U.S. dollar. So it's not going to work.
We keep hearing that whatever the politicians are suggesting, and admittedly it's all been rather woolly so far, isn't right. Can you pin down exactly what would keep investors happy, make them feel more confident?
That's a tough one. Personally, it doesn't matter. I'm a trader. I don't really care about that kind of stuff. I go with if I see an opportunity to make money, I go with that. So for most traders, it's not about, it's that we don't really care that much how they're going to fix the economy, how they're going to fix the whole situation. Our job is to make money from it. And personally, I've been dreaming of this one for 3 years. I had a confession, which is, I go to bed every night, I dream of another recession. I dream of another moment like this. Why? Because people don't seem to maybe remember, but the 30s depression, the depression in the 30s, wasn't just about a market crash. There were some people who were prepared to make money from that crash. And I think anybody can do that. It isn't just for some people in the elite. Anybody can actually make money. It's an opportunity. When the market crashes, when the euro and the big stock markets crash, if you know what to do, if you have the right plan to set up, you can make a lot of money from this. For example, hedging strategies is one. than investing in bonds, treasury bonds, that sort of stuff.
If you could see the people around me, jaws have collectively dropped at what you've just said. I mean, we appreciate your candor. However, it doesn't help the rest of us, does it, or the rest of the Eurozone?
I would say this to everybody who's watching this. This economic crisis is like a cancer. If you just wait and wait thinking this is going to go away, just like a cancer, it's going to grow and it's going to be too late. What I would say to everybody is get prepared. This is not a time right now to wishful thinking the government is going to sort things out. The governments don't rule the world. Goldman Sachs rules the world. Goldman Sachs does not care about this rescue package, neither does the big funds.
Okay. Nice to know someone's being honest. Goldman Sachs rules the world. He loves the idea that there's a bad time for hundreds of millions of people in America. He wakes up in the morning excited that he can exploit our pain, our suffering, the loss of our homes, hungry children, laid off workers, in services essential to the quality of our life. That's what he looks forward to. He, Goldman Sachs, the President of the United States, the politicians, you heard him say it. All the ruling elite, they don't care about what happens as long as they can profit from it. Thank you. Now, I realize it's a hard, hard thing for Democrats to listen to. They don't listen to that. They'll be angry at that. Who are the people responsible? Bill Clinton, a Democrat, and all the other suck-ups like him in Hollywood, the Steven Spielbergs, the Barbra Streisands. As long as they get their night in the White House, as long as they get their place at the table, as long as their brokers make money for them, as long as they can keep up their lifestyles, and the Bruce Ratners and the Michael Ratners and all the others, as long as they have their money flowing, do they ever do anything that challenges the underlying power structure? Not at all. Instead, the Nation magazine, shame on the Nation magazine for it once again failing in an opportunity to say Barack Obama had betrayed all of the principles, get rid of him for another candidate, get a progressive candidate, get, I don't care what label you put on him, get someone who cares about the people. They come right back and say, well, you know, now he has a chance to start over. And you see Rachel Maddow, same suck up, same individuals doing the same thing. They can't wait to apologize for this man and say, well, he's still better than any Republican. And this man just said it. Maybe this is just too hard for you to understand. Maybe you just won't allow your own ideological rigidity to accept this. No one in power gives a about you. All you are is a profit stream. You're nothing more than something that can be commodified for their needs. And their needs are insatiable. They're deep, they're dark, and they're extraordinarily immoral and selfish. It is not about Democrats or Republicans, and for God's sakes, don't come on this show or anyone else's and once again apologize, saying the president would do the right thing if it weren't for those bad Republicans. This is a man who only honors power. Every choice he's made, every person he's put in there, you cannot make 1,600 wrong choices in a row. You cannot overlook all the progressives, the humanistic, the spiritual people in any given movement, in any given position that could have helped us. These were the Larry Summers, the Timothy Geithner, the bailouts, the Federal Reserve, the wars in Iraq, the Halliburtons, the insurance companies, the oil cartels, the nuclear industries. You insult our intelligence. You betray any modicum of intellectual authenticity or spiritual decency when you once again show us that, he's our man. He's your man, Jack, not ours. The rest of us have got this message a long time ago. Some of you are a little slow. Some of you took a little longer on the uptake. And the rest of you are dyed-in-the-wool ideologues. And I don't care what this man did. If he started another war tomorrow in Iran, you would find a way to apologize for it. And so would the Nation magazine. Shame on the Nation magazine. Shame on the Nation magazine for being nothing more than card-carrying Democrats and faux liberals. Real liberals long ago abandoned this man. Those are my personal thoughts. You have a chance to share yours in a moment. Now on to health and nutrition. Back in a little while on another topic. Let's go to health and nutrition for a few moments before we go to our special investigative report. How to enhance the heart-healthy benefits of fish oil, from a Dr. Michael Smith. Well, the omega-3 fatty acids. Now, I'm a vegan, so I can get mine by mixing flaxseed oil. Also, I can mix in walnut oil or eat walnuts or walnut butter. That works too. Avocado, avocado oil, almond oil, that's good too. And hemp oil, that's also good. Or you can take, as most people do, the fish oils. And here's what's going to happen. Four things that are important. A, you can lower your systemic inflammation in the body. I don't care whether it's in your heart, your brain, your eyes, your musculature. You can lower inflammation, and that's the number one cause of disease. Inflammatory reaction in the cell is what damages your DNA, and then how long it takes the DNA to be repaired, if at all, whether that DNA damage ends up as a cancer or macular degeneration or destruction of your arterial walls or amyloid plaque in the brain. It gets there by inflammation. And inflammation is caused by our diet, what we drink, what we eat, and our stress levels. So when you take in the omega-3 fish oils, you're turning off inflammation. You're helping your heart function better, your brain function better, and you're giving yourself a better mood. Now, then we have to look at olive oil, because a lot of people believe that olive oil boosts the heart-healthy benefits of fish oil. And that's why in the Mediterranean, if you look at a Mediterranean diet, they generally have fish. Some have meat, but most have fish, locally caught fish. But they have it with a meal where the fish is cooked in olive oil, and the little appetizer is olives, a plate of different olives, or a plate of extra virgin olive oil where they give you a homemade bread, which is much heavier, much richer, much tastier than any of the bread we normally find here. And they sop up the bread as an appetizer. So you're getting olives, olive oil, and fish oil. The latest scientific evidence shows that when consumed in combination, the omega-3 fats and olive oil offer greater benefits than either alone. That's crucial. In one study, for example, Norwegian researchers studied animals with arterial plaques and administered a blend of omega-3 fatty acids and extra virgin olive oil. And what they discovered was amazing, that there was a significant reduction in the size of arterial plaques in the aorta and the aortic arch, and when you use both together. Now, what is it that you're getting? You're getting polyphenols, and that's what's healing. Now, you walk into a store and you get olive oil. Do you really know what oil you're getting? Let me just give you a little primer, just a simple little which oil you should get. Do not ever buy the refined olive oil, and that's what you get in most restaurants. This is the oil that comes from the second or third pressing of the olives. It contains not only the oil, but also the oil juice, which is very acidic. And that acidity is generally too acidic for human consumption, and that's what causes problems. And so then the moment you cook it, you're further refining it, and you add heat, you're refining it. And that's what they flavor meats and fish and poultry with. Well, they'll say, you know, virgin olive oil or olive oil, but don't. And if you see anything that says packed in olive oil, they're using refined oils. Don't use them. The second is semi-fine virgin olive oil. This is acidic oil that is left over after the first press, but is not refined. It's very bitter tasting when uncooked, but tends to be okay when cooked. I would consider this a very low quality. I wouldn't use it. The third virgin olive oil simply says virgin olive oil. This is the oil from the first press of olives. It contains no olive juice, only the oils. Its overall acidity is low, but it tastes best lightly cooked. Then the number fourth is extra virgin olive oil. This is the lower in acidity, that's good, than virgin olive oil. And the lower acidity gives it a fruity taste and deeper aroma and color. It's good on salads. And then the best of all, if you really want to go out of your way, only buy premium extra virgin olive oil. This olive oil is the lowest in acidity, which is the best, but it has the best flavor. It tastes great uncooked, and it makes the best dressings and also serves as a great dipping. And that's the olive oil you should use, along with your omega-3 fatty acids. And lastly here, when it comes to antioxidants, I know many of you are using your antioxidants daily. The question is, what are the best fruits? Well, a new study is out. And this is interesting because they measured the antioxidants as ORAC. ORAC stands for oxygen radical absorbance capacity. That measures the antioxidant power of different food sources. The higher the ORAC value, the greater the food's antioxidant power, therefore the greater healing. Now, here's what this does. It inhibits the proliferation of prostate cancer cells. It enhances nitric oxide production and improves endothelial cell function. It inhibits cholesterol oxidation by increasing a particular chemical. It reduces the incidence and number of skin tumors. It prevents platelet clumping and clot formation, therefore protects you from stroke, and it lowers the bad LDL cholesterol. So terrific for you, you bet. Now, they took the ones that were at the top of the list, and I'll bet many of you are using these. In fact, I know many of you are using these. Acai, number one. Pomegranate, number two. Blackberries, bilberry, blueberries, plums, raspberries, strawberries, oranges, and elderberries. From 18,000 to 2,000, that's your top group of fruits. So most people only get one of those every 3 days. I'll bet many of you are getting all of those every day. So you're way ahead of the curve. You are doing so much good for yourself when you're taking in your ORAC protective antioxidants from natural fruits. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Nall. We do more original investigative reporting than any other radio program in the United States. Let us continue with that tradition with part two. Part one is up on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, GaryNall.com, and it is the challenging the safety and efficacy of the Gardasil vaccine. And this is part two, which is the myth that vaccination equals immunization. This will also be up today, so you can read it with all of the peer review footnotes. The issue is this. Currently, the American public, through our governmental agencies, the CDC, the FDA, the U.S. Public Health Service, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, is being told that only by vaccinating all children and infants, all adults, including senior citizens, can we confer complete protective immunity from major diseases, whether it's the H1N1 or the seasonal flu or chickenpox, measles, hepatitis, etc., to any given individual. Their arguments, however, have never been put to the real test. It is virtually impossible to have an open, independent, objective, scientific, and public health discourse. You either accept without challenge that vaccines provide permanent lifetime immunity, or you are immediately relegated as a quack. However, a careful analysis and review of the scientific literature shows that no vaccine or combination of vaccines can be proven to confer complete and lifetime immunity and be safe for any given individual. Dr. Thomas Jefferson, epidemiologist and reviewer at the esteemed Cochrane Collaboration, out of Rome, has researched and written widely on respiratory infections, especially influenza. In an interview with German's Der Spiegel magazine, Dr. Jefferson made the following comments regarding the flu vaccine, which we're now being told as we speak to take. Quote, an influenza vaccine is not working for the majority of influenza-like illnesses because it is only designed to combat influenza viruses. For that reason, the vaccine changes nothing when it comes to the heightened death rate during the winter months. And even in the best of cases, the vaccine only works against influenza viruses to a limited degree. Among other things, there is always the danger that the flu virus in circulation will have changed by the time that the vaccine product is finished, with the result that in the worst case, the vaccine will be totally ineffectual. In the best cases, the few decent studies that exist show that the vaccine mainly works with healthy young adults. With children and the elderly, it only helps a little, if at all. These are the exact groups that the flu vaccine is recommended for, which is one of the contradictions between scientific findings and scientific practice, between evidence and policy. Of course, that has nothing to do with the influence of the pharmaceutical industry. It has everything to do with them. But it also has to do with the fact that the importance of influence is completely overstated. It has to do with research funds, power, influence, and scientific reputations. I can't see any reason to accept that continuing to vaccinate people for the seasonal flu will do any good at all. End quote. Now, as an aside, I would challenge one thing Dr. Jefferson said. He says that it's only been shown to work in healthy people, young people. He and no one else in the world can prove that you did not get the flu if you're healthy because you got the vaccine. As I could not prove that you did not get a cold because you took vitamin C. I can only state that if I had 10,000 people who only took vitamin C and 10,000 people who took no vitamin C, at the end of a given season, you compare epidemiologically how many people who took vitamin C got a cold and how many didn't. You can only guess at this, and that is what we've done with the flu. So if he's saying, well, it only works seemingly in healthy people, how do you know that the person's natural immunity, their natural health, prevented them from getting the flu? They can't prove that it was vaccine. There is no way in the world any scientist can prove that. It is unprovable. And yet they use this because, you know, the public is scientifically illiterate and will not question them. But then there's something more. There is Dr. Maurice Hellermann, arguably the most famous vaccine scientist in American history. He was the pioneer in the field of vaccine research and worked at Merck in the 1950s. He developed more than 40 vaccines, including 5 of the 14 immunizations routinely given to children and adults today. In a very candid interview right at the end of his life, Hellermann related that monkeys were used in most of the vaccines and that they could not screen out the viruses, that all the monkeys carried viruses. Hence, even in the new Sabin polio vaccine, they found simian virus 40, a DNA virus that has the potential to cause tumors. In fact, the SV40 caused tumors in the hamsters they were testing on the vaccine. Also developed at the time, the yellow fever vaccine contained leukemia viruses. Hellermann said on the record near his death, quote, "We knew it was in our seed stock from making vaccines. It was good science at the time, but that was what you did. You didn't worry about these wild viruses," unquote. That wasn't completely true, because also in the same interview, he met with Sabin, and he said, "We have all these hamsters who develop cancer from your vaccine." Sabin freaked and said, "What do we do?" And he said, "We do nothing. Because by the time these cancers show up in humans, it'll be decades from now, and no one will be able to track it back to the vaccines." So let us be very clear on what I'm stating, and what Hellermann himself stated as a matter of record, that no national network, no major media organization, no government agency has chosen to post. But we have, and it is posted. The founder and father of vaccination in the United States has now gone on the record saying that all of the vaccines they created had viruses that could cause cancer. So much for vaccine safety. In a careful analysis of thousands of articles that I've done over the last year, only from peer-reviewed literature on immunology, nowhere can we find a gold standard, a double-blind, placebo-controlled human study that proved that any vaccine or combination of vaccines can be shown to provide lifetime immunity and safety to any individual, any given individual. It does not exist. For example, there is no study that showed 5,000 children never vaccinated compared to 5,000 children fully vaccinated, following them for 6 years, and every month or every quarter checking their immunological status, their antibody status, and then the incidence of illnesses and deaths in both groups over that period of time to make an accurate or fairly accurate assertion that those who were not vaccinated or those who were vaccinated, how did they compare? If that's not done, then you have no good science. And we have no good science. There's an official term used by research scientists and epidemiologists when evaluating vaccines, a term that never makes it to the mainstream media. It is called vaccine failure. Vaccine failure refers either to the lack of effectiveness of the vaccine, primary failure, or the waning of immunity, secondary failure. The CDC, the FDA, the vaccine manufacturers, the healthcare professionals alike bombard us with a barrage of advertising designed to make us believe that vaccines are critical to health, our good health, and disease prevention, such that we have lost the capacity to ask the simple and obvious question. Will vaccines keep me and my family from getting sick? Is there proof that we will absolutely be protected for life and not injured? In my report, I will discuss this in depth. In a moment or two, the myth of vaccine immunity. The full report. The 2010 whooping cough outbreak in California caused 9,100 people to become ill and 10 babies died, prompting officials to recommend an additional booster shot for 12-year-olds. So far, up to this point in 2011, California schools have already turned away thousands of middle and high school students who have not gotten the recommended booster shot, even if they had the original vaccine. Whooping cough, or pertussis, packaged together with diphtheria and tetanus, is given according to a robust vaccine schedule of 5 shots by age 6, the most of any childhood vaccine, at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, 15 to 18 months, and 4 to 6 years. The whooping cough outbreak prompted much hostility and accusations towards parents who chose not to vaccinate their children, along with a clamor to add yet more booster shots. Even adults are now being asked to get a booster vaccine every 10 years. But was the outbreak caused by the anti-vaccine sentiment of Marin County and elsewhere? That question was answered without fanfare during the second week of September with a study showing that the whooping cough vaccine given to babies and toddlers loses most of its effectiveness after just 3 years. Dr. David Witt, lead researcher and chief infectious disease counselor at Kaiser Permanente Medical Center in San Rafael, California, said in a rare moment of frankness, quote, "I was disturbed to find maybe we had a little more confidence in the vaccine than it might deserve," unquote. The study looked at 15,000 children in Marin County, California, and found that youngsters who had gone 3 years or more since the last of their 5 original shots were as much as 2,000% more likely to become infected than children who had been recently vaccinated. Dr. Witt revealed his own pre-study bias, saying that when he began the study, he expected to see the illness concentration in unvaccinated children increase, but what he found was that more than 80% of the children who developed whooping cough were fully vaccinated. So perhaps unvaccinated children aren't the problem. During January 1st to May 20th, 2011, a total of 118 cases of measles were reported to the CDC from 23 states in New York City. There were no fatalities. Among the 118 cases, 105 were both import and associated and unvaccinated. Of the 87 U.S. residents who came down with measles, 74 unvaccinated, 39 under age 20, 35 under age 20 and older. The CD focused heavily on the unvaccinated measles victims while giving no time to the analysis of those vaccinated individuals who became ill. In fact, 13 of the group, which is 17.5%, had received all of the MMR vaccines, but got measles anyway. So while the CDC uses these incidents of disease outbreak to stress the need for vigilant adherence to the vaccine schedule, the real take-home message should be, you had 17.5% of a group of fully vaccinated individuals who got sick despite the vaccine. Therefore, how in any honesty can you say that full vaccination imparts full immunization for life, when clearly that is not the case with diphtheria, it's not the case with measles, in fact, it's not the case with any of your vaccines? And also, what about the side effects, the consequences of coming down with something like the measles once you've been vaccinated? Well, guess what we have found from the scientific literature? Those who had measles early in life and developed natural immunity, they were immune for life. Those who took the vaccine for measles and hence had no measles, when they did get the virus later in life and got complete measles, they had a much more severe case of measles and risked dying. So that meant that the vaccine actually created a more vulnerable state if you come down with the disease. None of this is discussed. None of this is offered as some reason for caution, some reason that we should have a more open and honest dialogue on this. Now, the unvaccinated people in this group recovered. All of them recovered. Now they have lifetime immunity against measles. For the ones who got the measles despite having been vaccinated, we won't know yet. Could the vaccine prevent these people from developing a normal lifetime immunity? So far, researchers have taken this issue as a given. They have not done their homework. Likewise, there was a 1985 outbreak of measles in a Texas community in which 14 students out of 1,806 contracted measles. But all of the students were vaccinated, no exceptions, and no reports of exposure from a foreign endemic area for any of the students, which meant that it was not protective for all the students. Therefore, how do we know which students in the future will be fully vaccinated but not protective? This is another case where 14 students were fully vaccinated, but they were not protective. Therefore, science has an inbred arrogance in suggesting around vaccination that vaccination imparts immunization. And we're saying, no, it doesn't. You can't prove that. It's not in the scientific literature. You may have antibodies. That's correct, but you cannot prove that high antibodies are lifetime protective, nor can you prove that low antibodies are non-protective. Let me give you another example with mumps. It's another virus frequently found to arise in vaccinated populations. In 2006, the U.S. experienced the largest nationwide mumps epidemic in 20 years, primarily affecting college students in dormitories and characterized by a two-dose failure rates among college students vaccinated in childhood. Authorities tried to blame the outbreak on crowding living conditions in dorms instead of considering the obvious. The vaccine simply isn't effective very long, or if at all, because these were students who had been vaccinated. In 2009 and 10, New York and New Jersey witnessed more than 1,500 cases of mumps among highly vaccinated groups. 88% of the affected children had received at least one vaccine, while 75% received the recommended two vaccines. According to Dr. Jane Zucker, New York City Assistant Commissioner of Immunization, quote, "We know that approximately one in every 20 people who are vaccinated may not develop antibodies." A Reuters reporter went even further, stating, quote, "The mumps virus can mutate, so people who have been given one or even two doses of vaccine remain vulnerable." Well, my question is, how can a vaccine with such negligible long-term immunity not only be recommended but required for school attendance? Then chickenpox or varicella is yet another example of a vaccine that does not work as well as doctors would have us believe. After one shot of the vaccine, which was licensed in the United States in 1995, about 25% of the children were still spreading the virus or getting sick themselves even after they had been vaccinated. Ann Gershon, a chickenpox expert who is director of the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at Columbia University Medical Center, said, "We really need boosters of vaccines much more than we thought we ever would." Well, no one questions this conclusion. How many boosters would be enough? Our vaccines do not confer an immunity that lasts. So to counter the steady waning of effectiveness, more and more and more vaccines are required. So in 2006, the CDC recommended that a second chickenpox be added to the list of childhood vaccines. Gershon said, quote, "It looks like a second shot will keep children from getting sick." Not exactly a reassuring prediction. It is time for us to demand that the makers and proponents of these vaccines answer the question, are these marginally effective and potentially hazardous vaccines even worth the risk? Many parents are starting to think they are not, especially in a case like chickenpox, which generally causes mild disease while conferring the benefit of permanent immunity. The most glaring example by far of a vaccine with limited immunogenicity is the flu vaccine. Created from a combination of strains that have occurred previously, the flu vaccine is given in a type of Russian roulette, with vaccine makers hoping that one or more of the strains might actually be the one that is most prevalent in a given year. Can they predict success with any accuracy? No, absolutely not. Does the flu vaccine confer long-lasting immunity? Absolutely not. If it did, the CDC would not recommend since 2010 that everyone over the age of 6 months get a flu shot every single year. On the subject of immunity, all the CDC is willing to claim is that the flu shot will last throughout the entire flu season, which is considered to be December through March, a mere 4 months. The evidence is overwhelming that vaccines lack the ability to confer a long-lasting immunity. Despite such evidence, however, the deck is cleared stacked to the top on the side of the pro-vaccine CDC, the FDA, and vaccine manufacturers. It seems anti-American and anti-science to be skeptical of the long-term benefit of vaccines, since there seems to be so much agreement both from the powers that be in the media. Vaccines are safe and effective. Too many Americans unquestioningly roll up their sleeves for everything the CDC recommends without considering the consequences. They want us to believe that there are simply no simple answers to the question of whether natural immunity caused by the exposure to a germ is better than the industrial version. In fact, there are simple answers, obvious answers, but no one wants the public to stop and think about the fact that vaccines cannot be counted on to produce a lifetime immunity, while natural immunity can. Prior to the development of 36 childhood vaccines that we currently give to children under 6, it was common to expect for children to get measles, chickenpox, mumps, German measles, or rubella. These childhood diseases spread through a family, a school class, a neighborhood, usually causing annoying but relatively minor illnesses with a few days off from school, and then the child would recover and be immune for life. Parents actually went out of their way to expose their children to the diseases so they could get them over with. They weren't afraid of their children getting sick. So what has happened now? We've had a changing of the paradigm. Are we crippling our immune systems because of it? Since widespread vaccination programs against these diseases began in the 1980s and 90s, there's a trend to fewer outbreaks of illness, but the illnesses are more severe and unexpected. Despite the reduced number of cases, proportionally more of these lead to serious illnesses and death. The demographics have completely changed. Instead of a 7 to 10-year-olds getting the mumps, it is teenagers who are currently the most affected. Likewise, instead of the same 7 to 10-year-olds getting the measles, the traditionally affected age group for decades, many of the current patients are infants, who are much more likely to die from infection with the virus. Measles is especially hazardous to infants because the risk of complications. Between a quarter and a third develop some related problems, such as diarrhea, ear infections, pneumonia, or encephalitis. Numerous studies in peer-reviewed literature were examined to find that they came to the same conclusion. Women who became mothers since the mandate of measles vaccine did not get measles as children and thus do not have solid immunity to pass on to their babies in utero and via nursing. Vaccinated women are found to have significantly fewer antibodies against measles than women with natural immunity. Infants born to vaccinated mothers have lowered antibody concentrations at birth and faster decay of antibodies than infants born to women with natural immunity who have not been vaccinated. The CDC figures show how mandated vaccines in childhood has changed the faces of measles. In 1976, just 3% of all cases occurred in children under the age of one. Again, that's 3% of measles. Now, typically their mothers were born in the 1950s, well before the measles vaccine became routinely available a decade later. In the 1980s, as teenagers who were vaccinated as children, they began to have babies. Those numbers started to change. In 1985, almost 8% of measles cases were in infants younger than one. By 1991, it had gone to 19%. By 2000, it was at 28% of all measles cases occurred in babies under a year old. Babies used to be protected from disease through maternal antibodies, but this wonderful mechanism of the human immune system is being destroyed by vaccines. If we remain on the current trajectory of exponentially increasing the number of types of vaccines given to both children and now to adults, we will reach the point where we no longer have natural immunity at all, thus becoming completely dependent upon short-lived, meager vaccine immunity for our very survival against disease. But I raise a different question. Why aren't vaccines more immunogenic? The process of creating a vaccine involves taking a disease agent, rendering it gradually weaker and weaker, so the body's own immune response is triggered and antibodies are made. That's referred to as humoral immunity. But there is more to the immune system than that portion of it targeted by vaccine manufacturers. In addition to humoral immunity, which relies on antibodies, there's also cell-mediated immunity, which does not. Cell-mediated immunity involves the activation of macrophages, natural killer cells, antigen-specific cytotoxic T lymphocytes, and the release of various cytokines in response to an antigen. What is lacking in our current method of vaccination is a way to stimulate the entire immune response instead of just a portion of it. Normal exposure to pathogens, viruses and bacteria, for example, always begins in the nasal, ear, throat, respiratory passages, but never through injection. Once primary immunity has been established by infection, the antibody response follows. This allows the immune system to grow stronger and learn to bestow natural and permanent immunity to an ever-increasing number of pathogens. Vaccines injected in the body bypass cell-mediated immunity and overstimulate humoral immunity. This confuses the normal maturation and skews the functioning of the immune system. Humoral immunity becomes dominant, and the crucial cell-mediated immunity is suppressed. The result can be autoimmune disease and frequent infection. Research shows that vaccinated children, compared with unvaccinated children, suffer from 5 times more asthma, 3 times more allergies, 3 times more ear infections, and 4 times more recurring tonsillitis. We have tricked the immune system into not mounting an all-out response to a foreign agent. According to Zinkernagel at the University Hospital of Zurich Institute of Experimental Immunology, quote, "We have not succeeded in generating truly protective vaccines against persisting infections because we cannot imitate infection immunity that is long-lasting, generating positive T and B cell stimulation against variable infections without causing disease by either immunopathology or tolerance," unquote. So now disease outbreaks create panic and fear when they occur, followed by rage against the irresponsible parents who don't vaccinate their children for having created the problem. The argument from pro-vaccine individuals is that there wouldn't be any cases of measles at all if every child were vaccinated. As we can clearly see from my comments, this argument simply does not stand up to any scrutiny. There is no scientific validity behind it. The gold standard of scientific study requires a double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized trial to isolate the effects of one particular intervention. In order to evaluate vaccines properly, it would be necessary for vaccine makers to take every vaccine on the market and compare a group of non-vaccinated individuals with a group cross-matched who have been vaccinated, and then watch them for about 6 years, and then measure them to see who has created immunity, who has not. This type of study has never been done, nor has a retrospective analysis of vaccinated versus unvaccinated individuals been undertaken. And why not? The possible result might be that we find we have been sold a bill of goods about the long-term immunity and effectiveness of vaccines. Instead, we have clinical trials in which the individuals are vaccinated and success is measured by attaining a certain antibody titer in the blood. The protective level is arbitrarily assigned by the researcher. If enough vaccinated subjects attain the designated level, the vaccine is proclaimed to be efficacious or effective. But it is the same thing as being effective? No, it is not. To be effective, a vaccine would have to prevent disease, but effectiveness is never put to the test. The problem with proving efficacy is that antibody levels do not necessarily correlate with the immune system's ability to fight off disease. One rare prospective study, which attempted to evaluate this issue as it relates to vaccinating the elderly with the flu vaccine, found that pre- and post-vaccinated antibody titers, whether high or low, did not distinguish between subjects who could subsequently develop influenza and those who would not, which meant that how can we know if a vaccine will work or not prior to being released to the public? We can't. According to an article in the peer-reviewed journal Clinical Infectious Disease, since it is too difficult to prove effectiveness, the only way to try to evaluate vaccines is to scrutinize the epidemiological data obtained from real-life conditions. In other words, researchers simply cannot or will not adequately test a vaccine's effectiveness and immunogenicity prior to its release onto an unsuspecting public. The true testing occurs after the fact. Only instead of surveillance, it is more likely that vaccine manufacturers will try to keep adverse reactions and evidence of vaccine failure from the public. The party line is always that since actual results occur outside the limited confines of a clinical study, they are not reliable. The vaccine industry falsely claims that its vaccines work exactly the same way as active immunity or natural immunity. That's a lie. As I have shown, vaccines do not produce the same quality and strength of antibodies that our own body would produce from a natural infection and then recover from that infection. Nor do they initiate cell-mediated immunity. There are two major types of vaccines, inactivated killed and live attenuated. Inactivated killed vaccines are inefficient because one of the antibodies will be produced against parts of the pathogen that play no role in causing disease, and some of the antigens contained within the vaccine may actually downregulate the body's adaptive response. Also, vaccines of this type do not give rise to cytotoxic T cells, which can be important for stopping infections by intracellular pathogens. Live attenuated vaccines may cause the illness they are designed to protect against, either because they revert to virulence or because, for some individuals, they aren't sufficiently attenuated. If vaccine protection fades over time, then people are being persuaded to risk their health for very dubious benefits. But what actually caused the decline in major viral disease? Remember, up to this point, every major illness we have been told was eliminated through vaccines. End of story. But hold on, it's not the end of the story. Vaccination clearly does not guarantee immunity in any given individual. So what about the decline of smallpox, polio, tetanus, measles, diphtheria? Looking at the actual epidemiological data, it is absolutely apparent that many, if not most, infectious diseases started declining noticeably prior to vaccine due to significant improvements in the way we live. Improved sanitation, proper sewage disposal, clean water, improved nutrition, indoor plumbing, less crowded living conditions, elimination of child labor, and better hygiene were the real reasons disease incidence declined. Polio started declining in the United States in the 1920s, from 7,229 cases in 1921 down to 3,826 cases in 1951. By the time the vaccine became widespread in 1961, the number of cases were already down to 1,076. That means they had already declined by almost 90%. there is no convincing scientific evidence that mass inoculation can be credited with eliminating any infectious disease. Furthermore, if vaccinations were responsible for the disappearance of these diseases in the United States, why did they simultaneously disappear in Europe prior to mass vaccination? I have created a series of charts. These charts are now being posted on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, GaryNall.com, and on my Facebook page. These are all actual statistical charts from public health services that show each disease and the death rate from these diseases. For example, measles in 1910, it shows you how many people died. Then each subsequent year, and then finally vaccine introduced in the mass population, 1963, it was down by 99%. 99%. From 1900 to 1949, death rates from diphtheria declined from 40 per 100,000 to 0.4 or 99.4% decrease. It had nothing to do with the vaccines. You'd already gotten rid of 99% of the disease of diphtheria prior to a vaccine being introduced. The same was true with measles, 98% decrease, and all the others. Whooping cough, same way. You decline from 12 per 100,000 to 0.5, and that's a 96% decrease. So I've looked at all the major illnesses, including, by the way, even smallpox, getting the medical records from England, Wales, and Italy of scarlet fever and smallpox. And once again, you see the number of people dying in 1838 and every year up to the point where vaccinations were implemented. It was public health interventions. If I mention isolation, physical barriers, better hygiene, that were having a much better evidence base than vaccines. The data suggests that implementing such measures are effective and relatively cheap interventions to contain epidemics of respiratory viruses, with estimates effective range from 55 to 91%. Yet, we don't have this discussion. It simply does not appear in the press or in the halls of Congress or before any of the scientific boards in this country. In fact, our reliance upon vaccination in the U.S. may have the effect of breeding feelings of invulnerability, therefore ignoring simple hygiene measures. And while the encouragement of early treatment with antiviral drugs leads people to show up at the hospital at the first sniffle, thus magnifying the possibility of disease spread. And despite the decline in major viral diseases, there is a concern now whether these diseases are making a comeback, as we see from the recent outbreaks of whooping cough, measles, and chickenpox. Could this be due to the fact that instead of lifetime immunity, what we have now for younger people than the baby boomers is an artificial immunity based on vaccines whose efficacy wanes over time? Meanwhile, we're being deluged by the propaganda that tells us unrelentingly that we must subject our children and ourselves to multiple and frequent vaccines to save us from disease, and we fall in step with the program. Vaccines are a huge business. Pharmaceutical companies are inventing new vaccines every year, all with the hope of their being included in the mandated vaccine schedule, thus generating billions in profits on an ever-increasing basis. Unless parents sign exemption forms, children must be vaccinated before they go into school. This is the law, and legislation is controlled by lobbying, with a pharmaceutical lobby being at least the second most powerful in Washington. Vaccines are also the cornerstone of the Well Baby programs, and so fuel the livelihood of the entire pediatric industry. Increasingly, the baby program, the Well Baby program, has morphed into a Well Adult program, as diseases previously confined to childhood are affecting adults with no naturally derived immunity. We are all being pressured into getting more and more vaccines. Is there no surprise, then, that there are never any follow-up studies by the manufacturers about long-term effectiveness of vaccines? It would hardly be in their interest to do such a study that might end up proving the worthlessness of their products and the permanent damage to our immune systems. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you very much for listening to my report.
Garinal Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tabenfeld.